I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. With March creeping up on us, it's time to start stocking up on your spring break's reading material. Should you go for a bestseller or a lesser-known work, mystery or biography? Well, the book doctors are back today to recommend some titles worthy of your bookshelf. We'll talk about a graphic novel that details a man's search for love, sanity, and perfect architectural proportions, and Salman Rushdie's story of a son who travels to a magic land on a quest to save his father. Plus the newest novel about U.S. Marshal Raylan Givens. This time he's trying to stop two brothers in the business of selling body parts. So if you're suffering from a lack of literature and your reading list strikes you as listless, don't worry, the doctors are in. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Why read Moby Dick? Funny, I was wondering the same thing. Well, today we'll get a rundown on a new book by best-selling author Nathaniel Philbrick that attempts to answer that question as our book doctors pay us another visit. We'll hear about new books by Salman Rushdie and a pair of our top crime writers, Elmore Leonard and James Lee Burke. And we'll hear about a whole bunch of new books as well, too. Our book doctors today are Steve Paul. He's critic at large for The Star and editor and a one-time bookstore owner. Steven, nice to have you.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me back.
Mark Luce is here. He's chair of the Department of English and senior dean at the Barstow School. Mark, good morning to you.
Good to be here.
Katie Stover is also back. She's Reader's Services Manager with the Kansas City Public Library and the recipient of a national honor, the 2012 Allie Beth Martin Award, one of the top honors for public library service given by the Public Library Association. And Katie, congratulations.
Thank you, Steve.
So good to have you here, too. And also with us is Angela Cervantes. She's a writer whose first book was just accepted by Scholastic, and congratulations to you, too.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What's the book about?
My book is a middle grade novel about two little girls that go to volunteer in an animal shelter and all the havoc they wreak there at the shelter.
Well, that sounds pretty good. That's got to be exciting having the book accepted like
it's
that.
It's extremely exciting. It's a dream come true.
How long ago did you get the word?
Right before the holidays.
Yeah, that's a nice way to spend the holidays.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Katie Stover, how did you get the word about your big honor?
I was I had a phone call, and I was in the middle of typing out some emails and pick up the phone distractedly after I noticed it was coming from the Pacific Northwest, thinking it was a friend nagging me about a conference proposal. And I just answered the phone. Yes, hi, this is Katie. And she says, oh, this is the chair of the Allie Beth Martin Award. I'm like, oh, Allie Beth, yeah, I'm familiar with that. And I stopped, and I said, oh. I took off my glasses so I would pay attention to the phone and not look at the computer, and I realized this is the Allie Beth Martin Award Committee.
It's a big deal.
I need to pay attention to this
And it's
call.
For what exactly? It's recognizing you for what, Katie?
It's an award given to public librarians who demonstrate a wide range of knowledge in a particular area, a particular specialty. In my case, fiction, reading, publishing. It's been given to reference librarians. It's been given to business librarians. But it's only given to librarians who work in a public setting.
Hmm. And your wide range of knowledge is always on display here with the book doctors. So, congratulations.
This is part of it. I'm told that this is one of the little criteria that knocked me into the winner's circle.
Oh, good deal. Well, Steve Paul, what's new in the book publishing world these days? I just have taken note that Robert Caro's next volume, the fourth volume in his ongoing LBJ series, is coming out. And for political writers like myself, that's a very big deal because those books are just so dang good.
They were very good. It's been a long time since we've seen one of those volumes.
Oh boy,
and
no
that
kidding.
You're a step ahead of me on that one. But, you know, Caro was a monumental writer. I remember interviewing him 25 years ago, you know, when the first one came out.
And well, he's one of my, like, dream interviews to get here someday.
Yeah,
I would love to have him in here someday.
Yeah, no, he's quite a reporter and someone to look up to.
What else is going on?
Oh, you know, just the usual chaos and fear and loathing and all that stuff that's happening in the book world, that's happening in so many media you know, outlets, as we've talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, e-books are rising, Amazon. It's kind of, we've got this ironic situation now where everybody who used to root for independent bookstores are now rooting for Barnes & Noble because, you know, they're the last chain standing. Yes. And they're
what's
the,
that about?
And they're the bulwark against the Amazon's, you know, takeover of the universe. And so it's about the battle of the e-readers, essentially, and the battle of digital publishing. And, you know, Amazon is a big foot. Barnes & Noble still has much, you know, much influence in the game. They're fighting it out, and you know, with the demise of Borders, the other the other book chain last year, people are rooting for Barnes & Noble to hang in there. Because
I was going to say Barnes & Noble surely has gotten a bump out of this deal because Borders was such an intense rival to them for so many
years. Yeah, they have, but they still have a lot of real estate that they have to account for, and a lot of real estate. It's tougher to support that amount of real estate with physical books anymore, given the trend, the sales trend of digital and print books.
Yeah.
And so you're seeing those stores that are filling up with Nook readers and filling up with other kind of tchotchkes and things and gifts, and you're going to see, I think, more and more of that as the shelves get a little thinner and thinner with books. So it's interesting to watch, and we're in the middle of another transformation. I mean, we've been in constant technological transformation for the last 40 years anyway, and it's just been certainly fun and depressing to kind of be there.
It seems like that battle is very similar to the Netflix blockbuster battle in lots of ways, your bricks and mortar versus your sort of e-delivery. And, you know, I think that that why the independents are siding – so hard with Barnes & Noble, which is, as Steve pointed out, highly ironic, is that there still exists, even at Barnes & Noble, a book culture. And with Amazon, it's not necessarily a book culture, right? It's a superstore where you can get what you need and get it quickly. And yes, there are people that write reviews for them.
Cheaply and below cost.
Cheaply and below cost, exactly. Yeah. And they depend on user reviews. And so I think that push by the independents, who have been much savvier, I think, in the last, I would say, 5 or 6 years of sort of niche marketing themselves and finding what they may have lost with the rise of the big chains, that they appreciate that book culture, and what they see in Amazon is the demise of that.
Yeah.
It's just going to go away.
Well, are there other major titles coming out this year by major authors that people are sort of anticipating? Anything that's sort of coming that is on people's calendars here moving forward? Anything? Yeah.
You know, my head is swimming with what's out right now and what's out recently. And we're going to talk about one book that I think is going to be one of the books of the year. We'll save that for a little later, but that has just come out. But, it's hard to predict. I mean, good books are still coming out. I mean, and that's what's kind of amazing. And there was I've forgotten some of the details, but just a week or two ago it was announced a writer in St. Louis who landed her first book contract. Sorry, Angela, it was like $1 million. it was $1 million auction.
No, maybe Angela's $1 million too. She just didn't brag about
it. I can dream.
And so publishers are still fighting to land what may be very at least saleable or what seem to be saleable. They're good at creating hype for books that have, you know, great potential. So those things are always...
The Art of Fielding is a sort of prime example. It's a book that came out...
I'm a third of the way into that book, and I'm really enjoying it.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
You did not, right?
I did not. I made it 50 pages in. I set it down and picked up the Marriage Plot, and
What was your issue with it?
I didn't think he was that good a writer. I mean,
I think he's a great writer. How can we differ on that so
I don't...
Much?
Probably because I'm wrong. That's probably the main. reason.
Yeah.
What I found was that the writing didn't sort of blend together. That the tone was off. I'm a big fan of style and tone, and to me, this book just didn't have it. Now I've talked to people who have finished it, and they said it gets a lot better. But I simply, for me, that it's hard for me to just say no to a book. But it may or may not have been a present for my brother-in-law, so, you know.
It was a present to me from my sister-in-law.
Right. I didn't tell my brother-in-law. Luckily, he lives in Portland, so he's probably not listening, that I just didn't care for it. I didn't see what the hype was. If somebody tells me it's that good, right, and if somebody throws what he gets, $500,000-$600,000, I mean, it's an absurd amount of money, then I want it to be off the charts.
He got that much. Why? What did the publishers see in that book that put it over the top like that?
Something you can sell. I don't know.
Yeah.
Something
yeah.
you can sell. I mean, that really, and I think we've all sort of had those experiences with sort of writers we like or manuscripts that people have submitted or manuscripts we've read that we're hopeful that friends will see published. And they're great. And it always comes down to, can we sell this? It's like, the writing's great. We love it. It's great.
Yeah.
But our marketing guys don't know how to sell this. Hmm. And that's how that industry works.
Well, speaking of separating the wheat from the chaff here, Katie, the American Library Association is out with several lists. You have them right in front of you there. Notable books of 2011 and something, a new category I'd never heard of before, I guess because it's new. It's called the Listen List. What is the Listen List?
The Listen List, it was established this year, and it highlights outstanding audiobook titles that merit special attention by general adult listeners and the librarians who work with them.
Your fingerprints are all over that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I brought it today just to needle you so we could have our favorite debate.
And how do you figure out which books are great audiobooks? What are the qualifications to make that list?
One of the unwritten qualifications, you just can't write this into the qualifications, is we were looking for audiobooks that – we were looking for material that was transcended in audio, that to listen to it meant you were getting a better experience than you would by reading it.
How do folks have time, Katie Stover, to sort of sort through all those audiobooks? Because I imagine that takes a lot of time to get through, I'm sure, what are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of submissions there.
We do. We have a lot of submissions. And what we do is we read the reviews. I listen an awful lot in the car. I listen while I cook. I listen while I do laundry. And
typically,
we have a team of people.
Yeah, and typically an audiobook, an unabridged audiobook is 10 discs or more. I mean, that's at least 10, 12, maybe longer of listening for a book. And I don't know whether that's whether you do the math and it's longer to listen to a book than to read one.
I would bet it is.
Yeah, I think
one and a half times, two times.
For some people, it is. Yeah. I can actually listen faster than I can read. The older I get, the slower I am at reading.
Really? And you're a librarian.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
And an honored librarian.
And an honored librarian, yeah.
But I'm aging.
So which books made the listen list from the American Library Association?
Why Read Moby Dick?
Okay.
And this book made it because Nathaniel Philbrick did the reading, and he did a marvelous job narrating.
Yeah, he's been here before. He wrote the book about the Essex, I think, the whale ship, and
yes,
and just terrific books, yeah.
And Bossy Pants by Tina Fey.
Mm-hmm.
And now that is wonderful to read. She is funny, but
did she read it?
She does the narration, and to listen to that, you would not want to read it. You want to hear her voice say her words.
Yeah.
And then Last Days of Ptolemy Gray by Walter Mosley, one of his standalone titles.
Yeah.
Marvelous elegiac novel told in the voice of a 90-year-old man who's beginning to suffer dementia. And then trying to pull the fragments of his memory together before he dies. Mm. Just outstanding. And that is the sort of book that for some readers, no matter how good your imagination is, you probably can't pinpoint the right tones, the right emotions for every element of the book. And that's what these narrators do.
What's the name of that book again? That sounds so interesting.
The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray by Walter Mosley.
Wow. Who read that?
Dominic Hoffman. And he's outstanding. He's done other material. He's done poetry for young adults. He's done mysteries.
The association also came out with a list of notable books, Katie. Were there some you'd highlight from that list that people might recognize?
Notables, yes.
Notables.
James Gleick, The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood. Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand.
Yeah, right.
And Stephen Greenblatt's The Swerve, which was also wonderful on audio.
Is Unbroken still on the New York Times bestseller list?
It may be there
forever.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but yeah, it's... Yeah.
And some of the fiction, Tiger's Wife by Taya Obrecht, and
about Tiger Woods' wife.
Tiger's wife knew Taya Obrecht.
Yeah,
and this one. I know Swamplandia, Karen.
Oh, I love that book. Yeah.
Book.
All of those books, by the way, were some of the best books of the year in print, of course, too. And I would find The Swerve maybe hard to listen to. I mean, it's a well-written book, but the subject is so, somewhat arcane that I might find it a little difficult to focus while driving, which is when I consume audiobooks.
But. Angela, are you a big fan of books, audiobooks or not?
I have a few. I really love books by David Sedaris.
Yeah.
And
oh,
I love to hear his voice, read his words. He just has such a great humor in his voice, and it just comes alive for me. Mm-hmm. I just love it. Some of my best presents have been David Sedaris audio books.
My wife is in the same category. Do those books sell? Audiobooks, sales good?
Yes. Sales are very good, especially digital download and CD. Audiobooks are still selling in CD. And that's because cars still come equipped with CD players.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's go to a list of some of the books that our book doctors have been reading. And if our listeners want to chime in with some good recommendations, we're always open for business here. 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR. Steve, Paul, who are you up with here?
Well, I was this was totally unplanned and coincidental, but I was going to talk about Elmore Leonard's Raylan, another crime novel, which I consumed as an audiobook, and I don't pay quite as much attention as Katie does, and so I can't remember. I didn't bring it in, and I can't remember who the reader was. But he was very good, because he did the characters so well and delineated the characters so well, and that's a major achievement in a book like a crime novel by Elmore Leonard, which is populated with all sorts of ne'er-do-wells and thugs and crazy people. So including Raylan Givens, who is the central character of Elmore's, this is his third novel featuring Raylan, is a U.S. Marshal who seems to operate by his own rules. He's got a lot of guts, and he apparently is a good-looking guy because he always gets a girl or a series of girls. But anyway, I've never seen the cable television series on FX called Justified, but that is Raylan Givens. It's a series based on one of Leonard's earlier books about him. And so he's created this sort of multimedia stud character that some of the storylines actually bounce back and forth. One of the storylines that's in this new book called Raylan has actually appeared in on one of the episodes of Justified. So there's a little some feedback which I haven't encountered like I said, because I haven't watched the series. But Raylan is the moral center of this book, around whom operates a whole series of chaotic and violent things. It's a world of pot growers and strip miners and organ harvesters and gamblers and thieves and all that thing. It unfolds in kind of there are like three stories in this book that kind of loosely connect. So it's an unusual structure. It's almost like a three-act play in some ways. But what makes Elmore Leonard is just the way he writes and the way he drives a book with no unnecessary words and with amazing naturalistic dialogue. I mean, he just pushes you through and you get the sounds of these characters, and they're witty. They're sometimes witty, and they're, Raylan certainly is the wittiest and kind of laconic, but he always has great lines. But Leonard, who's been writing for about 60 years, is just a master of dialogue, and he writes these kinds of. This might not be the best Elmore Leonard novel, but it's a pretty good one.
And the title again is
Raylan, R-A-Y-L-A-N.
You sold that pretty well, man.
All right. Yeah.
Do you ever get the sense that he's writing for TV or not?
Yes.
I think he will admit
he thinks sometimes in those terms, just in the way that Cormac McCarthy kind of thought in movie terms when he wrote No Country for Old Men. That kind of thing. I mean, that is narrative, and when you strip it down and you have dialogue and action, I mean, that is the root of what you need.
Where is Raylan based in?
Well, this particular book finds him. He had a little trouble in Miami, and so he's been reposted to Harlan County, Kentucky.
Moonshiners and
you wow. betcha.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
Could be the Ozarks, right?
Yeah, it very much sounded like the Ozarks, and some interesting, very wealthy characters and very stupid characters, and you know. Great
Sounds
mix.
Good.
Yeah.
If our listeners want to chime in again with their recommendations for good books they're reading right now, 816-235-2888, or if they want to disagree with Mark Luce on the art of fielding, if you've read that book, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Gloria from Fairway. Gloria, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
I was calling because I'm reading a book called Flashback by Dan Simmons, and it is a little bit of science fiction tucked into a wonderful mystery that is a little bit close to what, well, I'm a little bit afraid might happen in our future. And I wanted to mention that I got it at I Love a Mystery bookstore that was dead, and it came back to life, and it's living in. They found this for me, and it's wonderful.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, Gloria, because I've heard it both ways on I Love a Mystery, the good store on Johnson Drive in Mission there, right? I've heard it's closed, I've heard it's open, and you're saying it's very much alive and well.
Oh, it is. And the one reason that it's alive and well is that people are coming to their going out of business sale. I mean, they were selling things off the wall.
They were on the verge of closing, and a whole bunch of community support erupted, and they stay open. Yeah.
Wow.
That's right. Thank you for mentioning that.
Well, Gloria, thank you.
I love it.
Thanks for your good call. I appreciate it, Gloria.
Sure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Angela Cervantes, let's go to one of your picks here. What would you recommend?
Well, one of my first picks is a book called Moon Over Manifest by Claire Vanderpool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book that took the author somewhat over 4 years to write. It's her first book, and it walked away with a Newbery Award winner in a prize in 2011. So not too bad for a new first-time novelist. The story is set in a fictional town in Kansas called Manifest, based on a real town called Frontenac. I hope I'm saying that right, Kansas.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I think you're pretty good.
It's correct. And the main character is Abilene Tucker, and she's a young girl whose father has sent her off to live with an old friend in Manifest while he works for the railroad. This is all based in the Depression era. So everything is, you know, pretty poor. The town is mostly full of immigrants who've come there to work in the mines. And while she's in Manifest for the summer, she just sort of starts meeting all the colorful characters of in the town. She meets a Hungarian gypsy woman named Miss Sadie, who through a series of flashbacks starts to tell her the history and the stories of all these kind of ordinary Kansas folks, but really their lives have been very extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of starts revealing the history of this town and finding out a little bit about her own father's upbringing in this Kansas town. And it's beautifully written, full of wonderful characters. There's a corrupt sheriff. There's a mystery spy only known as the Rattler. There's a bootlegger / science teacher / preacher.
Wow.
Just really gripping.
This book
very
is written
exciting.
For people how old?
Well, it's a middle grade novel,
mm-hmm.
which
it's
you know,
sort of
tends
right
to
down
be
your,
8
your,
to 12 years old. Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But I really say it's 8 and above. I think anyone could enjoy this book. It's just so well written, and I'm really eager to read. I believe she's going to come out with a second book, and I'm excited to read what she has in her future.
Claire Vanderpool is not from Kansas, though,
she
is she?
Is. She's from, she lives in Wichita, Kansas.
Oh, that's right. Okay,
yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah. Has she been here before? I think she's been here before. Now that I hear the Wichita.
That brings up a good, I mean, there we could spend the whole next half hour talking about young adult and kind of teenage fiction that has gotten an adult audience. I mean,
mm-hmm.
and I think that squarely falls into that trend right now. There's a lot of that going on.
Well, that's a kind of a Hunger Games phenomenon.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It took her 4 years to write it. Why? Do you have any insight?
Over 4 years. Well, she's a mother with 4 children, so she's fitting in writing in between making lunch and all the other
You know, it's that's not bad, a year a kid. That's pretty good.
When we first began this show, I remembered all our guests for about 3 months. And then suddenly the years pile up and I get home at night and Katie says to me sometimes, well, who's on the show today? And I have to stop and think about it because that was 6 hours ago when years ago I knew all the people who had been in here before. But, yeah, I think she has been here. Very interesting woman, Claire Vanderpool.
Yeah,
that book again is Moon Over Manifest. Okay. Let's go to some phone calls here. Skip from Kansas City, Missouri. Skip, you're on Up to Date.
Good morning. How's everybody today?
Well, thanks, Skip.
I wanted to call in and comment on the Elmore Leonard character, Raylan. I haven't read those books, but I am definitely a fan of the television show Justified.
Mm-hmm.
And just wanted to say that it's a fantastic program. It's a little bit violent, I think.
Oh, yeah.
But,
no doubt.
But that's Elmore Leonard, and the guy who plays Raylan. Actually, all the characters are just wonderfully rendered by the actors that portray them, and it's a fascinating story. So I wanted to encourage anybody who's read those books or familiar with them to check out the show Justified. It really is.
We'll do just to mention to you the two previous books. So this new one, of course, is in hardcover because it just came out. But the two previous books that are probably available in paperback are Pronto and Riding the Rap. And those are the two previous novels that featured Raylan. So if you want to go the other way, you could start with one of those.
And I wanted to throw out a couple authors I've been reading over the last couple years, more mystery, potboiler kind of things, but I really enjoy them. One is Lee Child, and he's got a recurring character by the name of Jack Reacher, who is a former Army MP, military police major, who travels around the country and gets just helps people out, and he's a big bad son of a gun. So, but it's really well done and exciting series. And the other author is Michael Conley, and his series about a LA police officer named Harry Bosch. Which is a really outstanding series, very well written.
I love those books.
I've read a couple of those.
Yeah. He also has another series featuring a lawyer, and occasionally doesn't he bring the two of them together? There was a book called The Lincoln Lawyer.
They're related.
Yeah, he does. As it turns out, they're half cousins or something like that.
Yeah.
Half brothers, I think.
Well, Skip, you got people's heads nodded when you when you recommended those books. Everybody recognized them here. So good recommendations. Thank you.
Thanks very much. They're really great, and I love your show.
Thanks, Skip. Let's go to Rebecca from Kansas City, Missouri. Rebecca, you're on with the Book Doctors. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I just wanted to comment on books that I think are much better in the audio version than reading. One is the number one ladies detective agency series by McCall Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Just to hear the Mama Musa character in her speak in the way I would imagine she might speak, I think really makes a huge difference. Angela's Ashes, written by Frank McCourt. Just hearing him speak in his Irish brogue just, you know, makes an immense amount of difference. And I would also just add Lord of the Rings trilogy. The language is poetic, and at least the actors that were reading the series that I saw or heard, all the characters were they were as authentic as the movie. Gollum sounded just like Gollum. And those I just felt like I couldn't enjoy as much just looking at the words on the page.
All good picks, Rebecca. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. And Becky from Parkville. Becky, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. You had mentioned, are people waiting, marking their calendars for books?
Yes.
I had been waiting for V is for Vengeance by Sue Grafton, the next step of her alphabet series. And I just got done reading it because I was in line on hold at the library and had to wait my turn.
Mm-hmm.
I think when I put my name in, I was number 376.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
And I had to wait my turn. But yes, people are still marking our calendars, anxiously waiting.
Was it worth the wait?
Yes.
It was. It was. I absolutely that series. I love that it takes place in the 80s.
Yeah.
And there's no internet. There's no cell phone.
Thank you, Sue.
She has to think about what she's doing. She has to pull over and use a payphone to call the cops and back up. Mm-hmm. I just adore it.
Becky, good phone call. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here with our book doctors. We'll turn to Moby Dick by Nathaniel Philbrick and a whole bunch of other books. And I'm still hoping someone will call in and take on Mr. Luce on The Art of Fielding. If you like that book, give us a call, 816-235-2888. Again, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's program about teaching evolution in our schools, you can find it at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, Primate Economics and the Weekend To-Do List. This hour, we're talking with our book doctors, Steve Paul, Mark Luce, Katie Stover, and Angela Cervantes. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Dr. Luce, what do you have up next year?
Doctor?
Doctor, yeah.
I don't see any doctor here.
I thought I'd make you feel good.
No, that's nice of you. You know, I got this graphic novel for Christmas. It's called Asterios Polyp. And it's by a fellow, fairly well-known graphic, like an illustrator named David, I'm going to butcher his name, Mazzucchelli. Asterios Polyp.
Wow.
His name was changed at Ellis Island. The guy just cut off the last part of his name when his parents came over in 1919. Asterios Polyp is 50 years old, and he's having troubles. He's at home when lightning strikes his house and ruins, burns his apartment down. He takes the money that he has in his wallet, and he tells the Greyhound agent, "How far will this get me?" What we find is that Asterios Polyp is a very well-known and well-respected paper architect. So he's almost like a theoretical architect. So he designs buildings that are never made, right? And he's a man who sees things.
A lot of regular architects do that.
Yeah, this is true.
Just so you know.
Yeah, you design a lot, never been built, right? Funding withdrawn. He sees when he was a child, his mother was going to have twins, and this brother died. And what we find as we read the story, it's actually his brother telling his dead brother, who was never born, telling the story. But Asterios sees things sort of in duality. So form versus line, Apollinarian versus Dionysian. And he's overly formal. We almost always see him in profile. And he falls in love with a young sculptor named Hanna, who grew up in she grew up in the States. Her parents emigrated from Japan. And so you sort of track their relationship, and you see Asterios isn't the most pleasant fellow, and he's a bit of a blowhard, but the nice thing that Mazzucchelli does is he sets what's happening to Asterios presently, which is he's started to work as a mechanic in this town that he ends up in, versus what happened with his relationship with Hanna. And one of the things that's so fascinating about it is sort of how it's laid out on the page. And it's exceedingly formally designed.
I'm looking at you're flipping through some pages here. It looks like a comic book almost. Yeah.
Well, it's a graphic novel, which is a polite way of saying a comic book. But the themes are fairly adult. I mean, this isn't the kind of thing you want your fourth or fifth grader necessarily looking at. But the formality of his design, the way that the frames overlap, the colors that he used, there's elements of cubism in it. There's elements of modern sculpture. It's extremely rich. visually. And it's heady. I mean, it's a fairly sort of cerebral thing. Him talking about, you know, the function of a space and what that means and kind of theoretical architecture things. But at its center really is the story of a man looking for what he's lost and whether what he's lost what he lost was his brother when he was young, but then he also sort of loses his wife. And it has there are plenty of sort of twists and turns in the ending. I was beyond taken aback. I was really
wow.
sort of shocked. But it's extremely rich.
You came across this book how?
Oh, I just, you know,
you stumbled.
Yeah, you stumbled.
Yeah.
It came out in 2009. You know, and the reviews, of course, are rave reviews. I mean, the one guy from the New York Times book review basically talks of the Odyssey. And it's like, well, let's not get carried away. I mean, there is a sort of journey element to it, right? Trying to find his way home in a way. But it's not Homer.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I mean, but I enjoyed it as much as any graphic novel I've ever read.
Okay. Asterios Polyp.
Oh, and the other cool thing. So I opened this book up and I found a card, Christmas card from my mother. Guess what I forgot?
What?
She gave me money. Oh. I found $50 when I opened the book.
Man.
That's why you like it so much.
Yeah, exactly. Explains everything. Okay, that's from Mark Luce there. Again, our phone number here as we talk to our book doctors, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Judy from Roland Park. Judy, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. My book club has chosen a 20th century Russian novel called The Master and Margarita. By Mikhail Bulgakov.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if the panelists had read it and what they thought.
Mark Luce
is nodding
his head.
Doesn't that have a talking cat? Doesn't that book have a talking cat?
Yes.
Yeah. He was the author, the book was published briefly and then banned.
Yes, after Stalin's death.
It was banned. It was only published after Stalin's death.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Did you guys like it?
We're going to discuss it next month. We're reading it now, and I wondered what you thought.
It's an odd book.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool, though. I mean, I don't want to sort of prejudice your reading. It's strange, and it's grown in stature, I think, over the years. It's a challenging book, certainly.
It's Pontius Pilate and Faust. Which is an interesting combination.
Are you reading it in English or Russian?
In English.
Okay.
It'll still be challenging.
Okay.
I would only have to say that it's one of the gaps, even though I have a deep Russian heritage, it's one of the gaps in my Russian reading. I have not read that one.
Okay. Joan from Kansas City, Missouri. Joan, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I just wanted to echo a previous caller talking about audiobooks. And they can be quite delightful. I'm enjoying Salman Rushdie when I go to the gym on my iPod, and I happen to be listening to Jim Butcher's, one of his series on the wizard, Harry Dresden, and ran through that particular CD, and all of a sudden there you guys were on books. And so I just wanted to say, yes, one of my favorite authors to listen to is Janet Ivanovich. Her audios, the person that does her audios, is very, very funny. And they're just a treat to listen to.
So, Joan, you can
and
listen
also,
to those books.
I've got regular books going, too. Right now I'm reading Bonhoeffer, which is pretty fabulous.
And, Joan, you can read, listen to books on tape, so to speak, when you're at the gym?
On my iPod.
On your iPod. Good for you.
Wow.
Good for you.
Yeah.
That takes some focus, doesn't it?
It's a lot more fun than music. I love music, but, you know, the stories just really take you away. So.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for the call, Joan.
Thanks.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Barb on Facebook writes us this. I've been plugging away at Neal Stephenson's ReamD for the past month or so. I'm about halfway through. It's more than 1,000 pages, and it's a great book, ReamD. Any thoughts on Reamde? We know.
No idea.
I've heard that it's really good. It's on my list, but it is very long.
Yeah,
so.
He's got a great following, and I have not read it, read about it, but it is certainly, you know, it certainly deserves his readership. He's a guy who tackles futurism and technological darkness and all sorts of things in our all sorts of bad things in our society. And
well, Katie Stover,
piles it into 1,000-page novels.
As a librarian, how long is a librarian's want to read list? I imagine it goes on a ways.
Oh, it's not just a list, Steve. It's a couple of bookshelves in my house.
<That's> Only a couple? That is.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, a couple. We're talking like double my height, Steve.
Yeah. Okay.
there's a lot.
Tell us about the book I mentioned in the introduction, Katie. Why Read Moby Dick by Nathaniel Philbrick.
Yeah, why read Moby Dick?
Why read it?
Nathaniel wants us all to read Moby Dick, and he knows that there's a lot of folks out there who can't bring themselves to do it. You know, he took this, what, Mark, it's about 800 pages of Moby Dick or
I will
so?
Depends on the edition.
Over 500?
I have read sections of it. I have never finished it. And I have no desire to finish it.
Well,
perhaps I should read this and then read Moby Dick.
Yes,
there you go.
You should. You should read this. Philbrick took 127 pages to write about Moby Dick. And what he writes about is his enthusiasm for this American classic and its importance in the canon of American literature. He does acknowledge that it's a tough read and that there are probably more folks out there who have picked it up and put it down, never to go back, than there are who have finished it. But what he does is talk about the germs of Melville's ideas for Queequeg, for the Pequod, for Captain Ahab, for even the whale, and what it all means. And he takes it, he doesn't just talk about it in a literary context. He also drops it into what was going on in Melville's life at the time, and then brings in his relationship with Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was reading bits and pieces of the manuscript as Melville was writing it, and talks about their relationship.
Wow.
And can even point to those parts of the book where Ishmael's character is based in part on Hawthorne.
Hmm.
And by the time I finished listening to this, and my book group's going to read it, Mark, so well, I promise to do it in print as well. By the time I finished listening to it, I can't say I wanted to go read Moby Dick, but I felt as if I could talk about it intelligently at any cocktail party ever.
Yeah. Like reading Cliff's Notes, but with a literary
fancy Cliff Notes.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I'm pretty certain Mr. Philbrick wouldn't want us to say that. But I didn't feel as if it were Cliff's Notes. I understood why people are enthusiastic about Moby Dick, and I got enthusiastic about Moby Dick.
Mark, why were you not enthusiastic about it? What was it about
the
book?
Well, at the time, when I was a kid, it was because it's giant. I mean, you look at that book and you're like, what?
And you have those encyclopedic interchapters that kind of slow you down. You want to get back to the story. And
there was a wonderful professor at KU, Beth Schultz, who that was her specialty. And I had – Beth did my honors thesis in humanities with me. And oh, man, I hope she's not listening. I just thought of that. Oops.
But she did a book about Moby
she,
Dick
well,
a
she,
few
yeah,
years
I'm painted
ago.
To the last. She did a book on Moby Dick and art. Yeah, she's done all kinds of stuff with Moby Dick. And she did an all-day reading where people read out loud the whole day. And I did I was like chapter 28 or something. And I enjoyed it. But when I found that when I sat to read it, I just
– yeah.
It was tough, but I was also, I mean, you know, you're 19, 20 years old. It's like when you're that age and you have a sort of bent to the literary, right? 19th century American wasn't really where I wanted 20th century Russian.
Yeah.
I wanted, you know, I wanted the stuff that was a little more edgy than some guy chasing a whale.
Have you read it, Angela?
No, I have no desire to read it.
Yeah, it's not on your list.
No, I'd rather read Raymond Carver all day.
Read this. But, anyone who's wanted to read Moby Dick and can't bring yourself to do it.
But the strange thing is, you know what? I love Billy Budd. I absolutely adore Billy Budd. And Billy Budd was found in his drawer after he died.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and Moby Dick, when it came out, was an absolute flop.
Mm.
I mean, it didn't sell anything, and it really isn't until, the late 1800s or early 1900s that people start to rediscover it, and it's not until the 20s that it's actually in the canon. And so it's a strange – I mean, it has a strange sort of – it has a strange history.
Yeah. The book, again, is Why Read Moby Dick by Nathaniel Philbrick. Angela Cervantes,
yes.
What else do you have for us here today?
Well, my second book that I recommend is called Luca and the Fire of Life, and it is written by Salman Rushdie.
I've heard of him.
Yes. This book was a gift to me at Christmas time from my brother-in-law, and so I really gave it a chance. I've tried other Rushdie books and not so much luck with those, but this one I really gave a good chance to, and I'm so glad I did because it's really, really, really good. The story behind it is that Rushdie's youngest son told him that he never wrote books for that he could read. He told his famous father, "You don't write any books that I can read," and so his father answered with this book. So it is considered a middle grade book, but it's really good. Any adult could also enjoy it. And Luca is a 12-year-old boy whose father is a great storyteller. He's also known as the Shah of Blah. And he's dying. He falls into a coma, and Luca finds himself in a position where he has to save his father. And to save his father, he has to embark on a journey into a magical world, steal the flame of fire, or the fire of life, and bring it back to his father. So you just kind of set off on this magic carpet ride through this magical world. Salman is just so good with his words, and he's so lyrical and funny at the same time that it's very fast-paced. Do you play video games, Steve, like Mario Brothers or anything like that?
Yeah.
There's a lot of references to video games in here where the character can save his level so that no matter what happens to him, he'll start back up at the same level. He has a life counter that tells him how many lives he's used up, how many more he has before he's terminated completely, and that makes it really fun. But ultimately, the story is really about the future of storytellers, which Salman Rushdie knows a lot about, saving their lives, saving the life of the story, keeping that sort of storyteller, legacy going on and on forever. So it's really beautifully written. I highly recommend it.
That's Luca and the Fire of Life, right?
Fire of Life, absolutely.
That sounds great.
Are there real magic carpets in it?
There is one major magic carpet in it. Yeah.
Real and magic at the same time?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, sometimes you use that just sort of as a metaphor. I'm not wondering if
it's
an actual
a real magic carpet.
Yes.
Sherman called and wanted to know if the book doctors know anything about Anne Rice's new book, The Wolf Gift.
Just came out. Haven't read it. Heard her talking about it on the radio the other day. It's werewolves in L.A.
Switched to werewolves
now.
Werewolves, vampires, boy, they're just everywhere these days. Becky on Facebook, the Harry Potter series is by far the best audiobooks I've ever heard. I actually like them better than the movies. Wow. Very good recommendation.
They are wonderful in audio.
I was going to toss out real quick on that topic. I don't know if John Le Carré is still reading his own novels, but I remember – I've talked about this years ago, but I remember listening to at least one of his novels read by him, and it was just beautiful. He had this – mellifluous British accent, and I think they're great. I hope he's still doing it.
Steve, Paul, you wanted to mention a book here. I hope I'm not I'm not catching you off your list here. Behind the Beautiful Flowers by Catherine Boo, who's a Pulitzer Prize winner.
Behind the Beautiful Forevers. Started reading it, so I don't want to get. I'm not going to go too deep with it, but I'm predicting at this moment that this is going to be one of the books we're going to be talking about at the end of the year. It's one of the best books of the year. We're going to be talking about it next year when during awards season. Catherine Boo is a journalist.
A distinguished journalist.
A very distinguished, relatively young journalist, but she's this is her first book. And it's based on the last 5, 6, 7 years living part-time in India. The subtitle of the book is called Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. Mm. And if you recall the movie Slumdog Millionaire, that might give you a picture of what she's writing about, which is very real place.
This is nonfiction,
but in a narrative style. She writes with and she's made a reputation as a journalist. She writes for The New Yorker now. And started out in Washington, worked for the Washington Post, now at the New Yorkers. And she's always done these kind of beautifully written immersion journalists basically with underclass subjects, underbelly subjects, underclass subjects. And here in India, she is taking us into an incredible world
of young trash traders slum. These people live in a slum which lies between a Hyatt hotel and the airport. They're squatters. And the first kid's ambition she introduces you to is to kind of he's had a little bit of success, you know, kind of rising up the trash ladder and has earned enough money that is aiming to earn enough money to kind of move to another place. But the way she brings you into this world is just phenomenal, and the subject is just heart-wrenching because she ties it into. You know, our lives here is so tied to India. You know, the global economy, all of those things come together in this incredible portrait of this undercity.
Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo, right?
Yeah, watch for it. Just came out. Just started reading. It's beautiful.
Well, book docs, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Really enjoyed having you all here today.
Thank you.
Great job, everybody. That's our book doctors today: Steve Paul, Mark Luce, Katie Stover, and Angela Cervantes. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Tomorrow, Primate Economics, plus our weekend to-do list. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kim Noble, Kathleen Pointer, Danny Alexander, and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.